This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
7:36 a.m. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar with Keith Kam and Wong Xiaoning. We have the breakfast grill coming up in half an hour. What's the conversation today?
So tomorrow, the 23rd of April, is the United Nations English Language Day. And did you know it's observed as both the birthday and date of death of William Shakespeare?
Really?
It is, yeah. Anyway, we'll be diving into the pivotal role of the English language in Malaysia, despite grappling with challenges such as declining proficiency. Our discussion underscores its global relevance and the imperative for educational rejuvenation. With a commitment to inclusive language policies, can Malaysia forge a trajectory towards holistic societal and individual advancement? For this, it will be a panel. Philip C. will be speaking with Associate Professor Dr. Ramesh Nair, the immediate past president of the Malaysian English Language Teaching Association, as well as Dr. Lee Soo Kim, the author and former Associate Professor of English Language Studies at Universiti Kebangsaan, Malaysia.
All right, stay tuned to that conversation after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. In the meantime, now we are turning our attention over to what's happening over in Washington, D.C. Now, over the weekend, the U.S. House of Representatives finally approved a $61 billion U.S. dollar bill to supply Ukraine with military aid. In a rare show of bipartisan support, House Speaker Mike Johnson put his position on the line by getting both support from mainstream Republicans and Democrats.
The bill passed the House on Saturday afternoon, with 311 voting in favor and 112 against. The Ukraine aid was part of a larger $95 billion package, which includes $26 billion for Israel and $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific region.
Now, the package of bills is expected to be voted on by Saturday as soon as Tuesday before it finally reaches the Oval Office and signed into law by the president. So what do these developments indicate about the lawmaking environment in the U.S. Congress?
So for a better understanding of the dynamics at play, we speak to Dr. Adrian Ng, a research fellow with the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. Good morning, Adrian. Thanks very much for joining us. I think we've been talking about military assistance to Ukraine for the past, how many months has it been? Why has it been so difficult for Congress to agree on a bill for foreign assistance to Ukraine?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. So the bill had been stuck in Congress since late last month. The problem was the last time Congress approved aid to Ukraine was in late 2022. And, you know, since then, conservative skepticism, especially in the House, about sending U.S. weapons and dollars to Ukraine has only grown. And it has split the Republican House conference into warring factions. So what it has done, it has pitted what we can think of as traditional Reagan Republicans who favor a strong U.S. Military presence and intervention overseas against newer Republicans who can be thought of as, you know, sort of MAGA or America First or Trumpist Republicans who want to limit spending abroad and to focus on problems at home, especially given the migrant crisis at America's southern border. And in addition to that, right, we have had some top Republicans in the House, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Republican Committee, who has argued that, you know, Russian propaganda has affected some of the Republican members, right, who are strongly opposed to sending aid to Ukraine.
So, Adrian, I was reading that House Speaker Republican Mike Johnson, he managed to usher these bills through by splitting the $95 billion U.S. dollar package in security bills into four bits. How does that work? And why did that get the buy-in from Republicans?
So I think, you know, he did that. But I think more important was the process by which he needed to forge a bipartisan coalition, right, with Democrats and moderate Republicans to overcome, right, sort of the opposition from the right wing of his party. So as your intro noted, right, a majority of the Republicans in the House actually opposed, right, all four bills, right, and the only reason that he managed to get the aid package through was his coalition with the Democrats. And he has done that before, right, in terms of funding the bills, funding the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown. And just last week, over the renewal of a very controversial program that allows for warrantless surveillance of Americans. Mm-hmm.
Do you think Mike Johnson can keep his job, though, as House Speaker at this rate?
So now that is the big question, because, right, even before the package, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a strong Trump supporter and a very conservative member of the House, right, said she has a pending motion to vacate the chair, right, which is basically a motion to remove the speaker. And this was used to remove Johnson's predecessor, Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Mm. And this motion has now been endorsed by two other members of Congress, right? But in the aftermath of the vote, right, Marjorie Taylor Greene did not trigger the motion to vacate. But over the weekend, right, she has basically said that Johnson's speakership is over. So, right, if the vote is forced, it is going to place Speaker Johnson in a very difficult position, right? So he could rely on Democratic votes to save his gavel, right? But that is not going to help him over the long run, because, right, if that happens, right, his job is basically over, right? Because, you know, in the eyes of conservatives, in the eyes of the Republican base, right, any Republican speaker that has to rely on the Democrats to keep his job, right, his career is basically over. But right now, it seems that there is a growing sense in the House conference that basically Speaker Johnson's days are numbered anyway, right? Because, you know, after November's election, there will be a new set of internal elections within the conference to pick the Republican leadership. Again, this is going to happen regardless of whether they retain the majority or not. And there is a sense that, you know, Johnson is not going to be picked for the top job in the next Congress. So basically, he is already a lame duck speaker.
So much to watch out for in the little bit of time before we even get to the November elections, Adrian. Can I turn our attention then to what's happening with the Republican frontrunner for president, which is Donald Trump? He is set to begin his hush money criminal trial today, actually, after 12 jurors were selected last Friday. How do these proceedings complicate Trump's election campaign?
So we are in completely uncharted territory, right? We have never had a major presidential candidate, right, sort of face multiple counts of criminal charges. So I think what has happened is Trump and his allies have, right, sort of created this narrative that this is a bogus charge, right, that he is being prosecuted and persecuted for political reasons. But right, sort of even somebody like Donald Trump, right, who has this reputation as being the Teflon Don, right, would, right, face difficulties if he is convicted. Again, right, if he is convicted on these felony counts, right, it doesn't disqualify him from running for president. Right. So the Constitution has only two bars for running for president. You have to be a natural born American citizen, and you have to be 35 years old at least, right? So being a convicted felon technically doesn't bar him from being president. But, right, it is going to create problems, I think, for Trump among independent-minded voters. So we, over the weekend, we just had a new Yahoo News YouGov poll that shows that independent voters, right, sort of think that the hush money case in New York now is a serious crime. And a slim majority of voters in the poll said, you know, should he be convicted, right, he should not be allowed to serve again. So it is going to create some problems for Trump.
And Adrian, on the other side of the coin, what do you see are the biggest hurdles for President Joe Biden's re-election, and how is he navigating these challenges so far?
Okay, so Joe Biden's problem is that his job approval numbers are underwater, meaning that more voters disapprove of his handling of the job than they do approve. And I think the most important part of that, his particular vulnerability is on handling of the economy. So if we look at the Real Clear Politics polling average, he's about 19 points down in his handling of the job economy. And that's primarily because, you know, voters are facing a cost of living crisis. Right. So Biden has been trying to make the case that his Bidenomics has made the economy very good. It's going gangbusters, right? There's job creation, inflation is cooling, but voters are just simply not feeling that, right? So food costs are up, energy costs are up, interest rates are up, mortgage payments are up. So what Biden has now tried to do is to move away from, right, taking this celebratory lap and you know, touting Bidenomics, and he's going down a populist route. So he is now going, right, against, you know, companies saying that, you know, something should be done to prevent companies from, quote unquote, price gouging. So, right. And I think it remains to be seen, right, sort of whether Biden resorting to this populist tack is going to resonate with the voters.
Adrian, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Dr. Adrian Ang, research fellow with the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, giving us some takes on what's happening in U.S. politics, especially in Congress and also with the election campaign. 7:48 in the morning, we're going to head into some messages. But when we come back, we'll be turning our attention to our own local politics, looking at PKR and their 25th anniversary, as well as strategies to enhance its political standing. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.